I'm a super, super nerdy person, and I write music from a historical perspective. You know, I'm not just writing about my boyfriends or, you know, my kids or my life, which is nothing wrong with that, but I just like there's enough people doing that. I don't need to do it. I do it a little bit, but I didn't really like it. So I'm like, you know, anytime I've written from a personal perspective, I'm like, never again.
Herzlich willkommen und danke fürs Einschalten hier beim Äpfelharmonie Talk. Ich bin Dominik.
Und ich bin Ivana.
Und in dieser Folge geht es um Rhiannon Giddens. Sie ist Sängerin, Komponistin, Banjo-Spielerin, vielseitig begabt. Und Ivana, du hast Rhiannon über Zoom getroffen.
Ja, genau. Es wäre natürlich toll gewesen, hätte ich sie persönlich getroffen und kennengelernt und etwas vertrauter. Aber ihr Reflektor-Festival in der Elbphilharmonie, das sie selbstständig kuratiert, das findet ja erst Ende November statt. Und gerade ist sie noch zu Hause, und zwar in Irland bei Limerick. Das hat mir ihre Assistentin kurz vorm Gespräch erzählt. Und das hat mich total überrascht. Sie hat ihre Familie dort gegründet, ihre Kinder leben dort. Eigentlich ist sie ja US-Amerikanerin und in North Carolina aufgewachsen. Und dort hat sie auch ihre Karriere gestartet.
Sie ist in den USA ja wirklich ein Superstar. Du hast es erwähnt, in Carolina geboren. Ihre erste Band hieß dann auch Carolina Chocolate Drops. Mit der Band hat sie sogar einen Grammy gewonnen. Und danach hat sie dort ja eine riesige Solokarriere gestartet. Vor allem mit amerikanischer Folkmusik. Aber sie ist darüber hinaus ja auch noch weiter begabt und im klassischen Bereich zu Hause. Sie hat zum Beispiel auch eine Oper geschrieben, die Oper Omar. Die hat einen Pulitzer-Preis bekommen. Und sie war mit ihrem Banjo auf Beyoncés Country-Album ja sogar zu hören bei dem Song Texas Hold'em. Also in den USA kennt sie ja wirklich jedes Kind.
Ja, und bekannt ist sie ja vor allem für das Banjo. Sie hat zwar Gesang studiert, genauer gesagt Operngesang, aber nach dem Studium hat sie das Banjo für sich entdeckt und sofort lieben gelernt, auch vor allem den Sound. Das Banjo ist ein Instrument, das ist tief verwurzelt in der Geschichte der Sklaverei. Das wusste ich selbst lange Zeit überhaupt nicht. Und genau diese verdrängte Geschichte möchte Rhiannon in ihrer Musik wieder hörbar machen und vor allem auch schwarzen MusikerInnen die Anerkennung geben, die sie auch verdient haben. Das sind natürlich krasse Themen und trotzdem haben wir viel gelacht im Gespräch. Das fand ich total sympathisch.
Und ihr habt natürlich auch viel über den Reflektor im November geredet, wo sie auch vor allem mit verschiedenen Besetzungen kommt. Sie wird natürlich auch Banjo spielen, aber sie ist zum Beispiel auch als Sängerin zu hören mit ihrem Partner Francesco Turisi, der wird Klavier spielen. Oder sie ist mit dem Silk Road Ensemble zu hören, das von dem berühmten Cellisten Yo-Yo Ma ja gegründet wurde. Und er war lange Zeit dann Artistic Director und sie hat jetzt von ihm diese Rolle übernommen und füllt sie eben in der Elbphilharmonie dann ja auch mit dem Silk Road Ensemble aus. Das ist eigentlich auch eine schöne Geschichte.
Ja, das ist ja auch ein grandioses Ensemble. Das verbindet MusikerInnen aus ganz unterschiedlichen Kulturen und sie möchten verschiedene musikalische Traditionen und Ideen miteinander ins Gespräch bringen. Und das passt natürlich zu Rhiannon. Das passt wie die Faust aufs Auge. Genau das möchte sie selbst. Nur kann sie jetzt ihr Banjo und die afroamerikanischen Musiktraditionen in einen breiteren globalen Kontext stellen.
Ja, da ist die Elbphilharmonie natürlich auch genau der richtige Ort dafür. Für das Silk Road Ensemble ist es eine Premiere, die sind zum ersten Mal in der Elbphilharmonie, aber nicht Rhiannon selbst. Die war ja schon 2024, vor 2 Jahren, also einmal im großen Saal. Und ich erinnere mich genau, es war so ein schönes Konzert und alle waren total begeistert. Und deswegen freue ich mich ganz besonders auf dieses Reflektor Festival im November. Und mehr dazu erfahrt ihr jetzt im Elbphilharmonie Talk.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Rhiannon, I'm genuinely so excited to talk to you today. You're such an outspoken and active artist. And I feel like this conversation could go in 100 different directions. The banjo, opera, black string band, Silk Road Ensemble, storytelling in general, your book publication, etc., etc. And it's somehow all those things quite naturally belong together in your musical home. You can't really separate them anymore. They just go together. And that's a beautiful thing to witness as the audience, as a listener.
Well, I say to folks, you know, I'm actually just telling the same story, but in like every discipline I'm offered an opportunity to tell the story in, you know? So they're all tied together. Everything that I do is really still the same thing. It's just like an opera form. It's in ballet form. It's in book form. It's telling the same story of people coming together and creating something new and surviving pretty harsh circumstances, you know.
Talking about your musical home and your actual home, Aoife, your assistant, told me you are in Ireland at the moment, mm-hmm. that you're at mm-hmm. home in Ireland. How long have you been living there?
I've been there about 10 years, I guess, like coming back and forth. Like I've been solid here it starts to add up, you know, I say 8 to 10 years. Like my kids have been in school here since they were little. So long time.
That is a really long time. Dia Gwich, by the way. It's been, I haven't heard Irish or spoken Irish in such a long time.
Impressive. Why do you speak Irish?
I lived in Dublin for my studies, and while I was there, I really tried to learn the language. I feel like there's so much culture and language, and it's such a beautiful language, and it just breaks down barriers and makes you connect with people really well.
That's wild. So you have the cupola focal. That's amazing.
That's a little bit, but it's been years.
Yeah. impressive that you remember. My Irish is terrible because, I learned a bit of Scots Gaelic years ago, and I sing in Scots Gaelic, and so it kind of ruined me for Irish because it's like starting to learn Spanish and then switching to Italian.
Yes.
You know, they're similar, but not. They're like, if you were fluent in one, you can kind of understand a lot of the other. But like, I'm not fluent in either, so so they just kind of mess each other up. Like,
it is quite confusing if they're similar, but not the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you talking about the first band you have ever sang in after college that did like Irish and Scottish tunes?
No, that's not where I sang in Scots Gaelic. I had a boyfriend. Who's become a friend, who was a Gaelic speaker, who kind of introduced me to the notion of the language, of the culture, of the idea that Scotland in particular is not a homogenous nation, that you have people who speak Gaelic, you have people who speak Scots, you have, you know, folks, all this kind of, the history is very complicated. And in America, we're just like, it's Scotland, kilts and bagpipes and do-do-do, you know, and that was my first kind of exposure to really the idea of European history being much more complicated than what we've been taught. Well, UK and European history, I guess we have to keep them separate. But the idea that there were within the nation, there were levels of privilege, you know, and there was, you know, violence, and there was intergroup warfare and all this kind of stuff. So it was just really interesting to think about that, and to think about the empire, you know, kind of colonizing its own self and its neighbors before ever going across the ocean.
But Irish influence in American music is also quite huge, as you.
Yeah, Irish and Scottish influence. Like, the Scottish influence isn't talked about probably as much as it should be, because it had a pretty heavy influence on the early, particularly early string band music. But yeah, and the Irish sort of music industry is massive. So there's all of this really interesting history. But then the Irish effect on American culture is really big. Particularly thinking about like New York and the creation of music and dance between Blacks and Irish musicians and dancers, like especially in the early 1800s, it's a really big piece of what becomes American culture. So it's just all of these groups have differing effects on the shaping of American culture, you know, including German, which is one that's not talked about hardly at all. But every group that came over has affected what became what we know of as American culture, some a bit more than others. And obviously African Americans become a very unique group within that story because of the way that they were brought over, because of the way that they had to sort of create a new culture within you know, in Turtle Island, whatever. Like, it's just, it's so complicated to even refer to America, because you have North America, South America, Central America, but all of it is colonized. So you always want to mention the original inhabitants who are still around, you know, but who were just, you know, that history is so, it's so violent, you know, and negative, but people have been surviving within that community as well, and affecting American culture. So, and being a part of it, mm-hmm. you know?
Yes, that's true. Talking about that, I immediately think of the banjo that you are well known for. And there's like this enduring myth in American music that it originated in the Appalachian region and was actually invented by Scotch Irish immigrants. And that's how you grew up to know the banjo, but then you found out its real history. Could you broaden the lens for me a little bit and walk me through the larger story of the banjo?
Yeah, so a couple of things is that it's really important to, as you know this, you know, in the work that you do, I'm positive, because it's part of it, is who tells history and why. When you're reading history, and this is something I've come to as a student of history, I didn't train in history, I didn't train in ethnomusicology. This is just me being curious and listening to experts talk about these things and realizing that, you know, what we think we know, there's lots of different ways that we get our information, and that some of those things that we just grow up knowing, like the banjo is invented by the Scotch-Irish in Appalachia, are things that sometimes are completely wrong. But my question is always, okay, so that's not correct. Why do we believe that? Who told us that and why? You know, so that's always the next question is, in whose best interest is it that we think this myth is true? So to walk backwards, the banjo is descended from African instrumental ancestors of the banjo. Lute, gourd instruments, they're semi-spike and spike, full spike, which means it talks about the fingerboard and the how it goes through the body of the instruments, all these sort of technical terms, but they're all lutes. They're all descended from, you know, stringed instruments that came over from the Middle East and even before that from China, you know, but they're all part of this movement of instruments that come with Arabic slave traders and all this kind of stuff that end up kind of in a lot of different parts of Africa. But what the most current scholarship is they think that the banjo itself, as we know of it, was invented in the New World, in the colonized world, in the Caribbean, and that it is descended from these instruments. But because of the nature of African culture, the diasporic culture in the Caribbean and eventually in North and South America, being a culture of creolization, because of the way they brought people, different groups from different parts of Africa, which is, of course, is an enormous continent. And then they smushed them all together in order that they couldn't communicate, you know, so they couldn't sort of overpower the European owners of the land and the labor and the bodies. So it becomes a creole type culture, and the banjo is one of the things that people start to create culture around, because it becomes a spiritual instrument and a ceremonial instrument, and is noted by observers, European observers, and they break the banjo, they try to take the power out of the banjo, they outlaw it, and but it survives and it becomes part of African Atlantic culture kind of all along, you know, particularly the seaboard, and eventually becomes adopted by other cultures within what becomes the United States. So in a folk transmission, so person to person, poor people all together, particularly in areas where there weren't big plantations. So in this area, the banjo starts to be transmitted from Black culture to white culture, but like in the late 1700s, early 1800s, and then it becomes a commercial instrument in the mid 1800s. And that's when it really explodes, is when people start making them to sell them. And the technology changes. It was a gourd banjo. It changes to a hoop, which is a much easier thing to produce. And the early banjo makers were tambourine makers. So even which themselves were coming from like Italy and Spain through like the UK and coming over. And so you have the tuning mechanism of the tambourine is lifted and and placed into the banjo creation. So the technology difference means that you can produce many of this exact same instrument. And then the last thing is that it becomes the instrument of blackface minstrelsy. So then it becomes part of the commercial music industry. And then from there, it's just, it's got all these roots and, you know, these branches that, you know, jazz banjo, Irish banjo, six string banjo in New Orleans. It's Cherokee hymns, you know, on the banjo, bluegrass country. It's like ragtime. A lot of ragtime was done on the banjo before the piano. Yeah. So it's an instrument that's everywhere, but what we're told about it is a very specific, very narrow story. And that's been part of the difficulty of trying to challenge that.
That's really interesting. First of all, so we actually cannot talk about the banjo without talking about the institution of slavery, because that's why we have it, why it exists. And also learning about its history opens up a different perspective on American music itself and how American music develops with all of these different directions you just named.
Yeah. 100%. That's why people ask me, why the banjo, you know, and they ask me in this way because they see it as this very narrow bluegrass instrument that does one thing. And I see it as an absolute representation of how American music came to be. It is the emblem. It has everything in it. Every genre, there's a piece of that is in the banjo. It was in the James Reese Europe's band. He was the music for the Castles. The Harlem Hellfighters, like, who went to World War One, spread jazz. I mean, you kind of scratch so many things. Scott Joplin, his mother was a banjo player. Like, his parents were string band musicians, you know? It's like, it is, you scratch the surface, you find a banjo. It was that ubiquitous, you know? And it was synonymous with Black culture for a long time. And it was synonymous with commercial Black culture, which i.e. like blackface, for even longer. And so people get confused with what was commercial, what was cultural, what started commercial but became cultural. Like, a lot of minstrel tunes were written, but themselves were kind of based on this musical language that had come out of a mixture of Black, white, and red sort of music. And then it becomes commercial language, which then those songs were written by minstrels based on that cultural mix then become our folk songs. Nothing is in a vacuum. You know, all of this is based on things that came before, which is why, like, for me, the history of America can't exist without the history of Europe. You know, they are inextricably linked in the history of Africa.
And what changed for you when you discovered the banjo's actual history? For you personally, for you musically, the deeper you've been digging, what changed?
What changed was I was like, oh, I can't trust what media is telling me, because I was told this thing. I saw this image. I saw the Beverly Hillbillies. I saw Deliverance and heard, you know, and I've heard a million banjo jokes. But I was like, oh, when you think about the 180 degree turn, the actual history compared to what we were told, it's mind blowing. So it really got me started on okay, what do I think I know and what do I actually need to learn? Who's actually telling the history as it was, and who's telling myth? And why are they telling the myth? See, it's really important to ask why. And a lot of times you dig into the myth making of the United States and it's white supremacy. And white supremacy is just an invented to maintain hierarchy. It's invented to maintain class division. It's invented to maintain an oligarchy, you know, an elites at the top and everybody else fighting for scraps. I mean, it's a very specific system that's very powerful and has been it's worked really well, you know. So these myths is why I also go, people are like, why is this so obsessive for you? And for me, it's like, it's not harmless. These things, like blackface minstrelsy, was never harmless. It was incredibly damaging. And these myths about why we have to fight to say, like, a Black wolf, number one, like, anybody should be able to play country music if they want to play country music. But like, the idea that we have to use so much of our time and energy to defend Black people's right to play the banjo or to play country music because of the history. And it's like, well, number one, everyone has a right to play this because it was a history. It's a history that belongs to everyone. This music belongs to everyone, but it's just, it's exhausting, you know? And it also, it serves the false narrative of we are essentially different, essentialism, that we are like, white people are like this and black people are like this. I'm like, it's just, it's a moving target. It's a never ending moving target. So why do we base anything on race when it's completely up to the people who are making this system up? I mean, like, my color could be anything. And then in reading about like eugenics and reading about like how the system came into place, I mean, it's literally just made up crap, you know, and we believe it and then we make it real.
Mm-hmm. Is that why it's so important for you to unpackage those myths within your music?
Absolutely.
As well?
Yeah. And music is a disarming thing. You know, you can get in there with a song and then you can kind of play and like, yay. But then you can go like, yes, but, you know, and that's kind of what I've been using music for, because that's what it is for. I think it is for to create these emotional pathways and then you can deliver the truth. You know, it's like this music comes out of working class cultural exchange. That's it. And anybody who tells you anything differently is invested in the myth. They're invested in the myth because they want to maintain their power. They want to maintain their gatekeeping, and nobody should be afraid of knowledge.
It is also a great opportunity to explore the history through the music. And it,
yes.
I believe that it can actually get a lot of people into history.
I think so too. I mean, it's definitely was my gateway to history. I didn't take history when I was at school. I never took a history class. And I just, what you said in the very beginning, you know, is what I tell people. You can't understand the banjo without understanding the transatlantic slave trade. And so that was my window, you know, that was my doorway in, was like, well, I want to understand why we have this instrument. And then you start, once you start, that's it. It's like, it's a slippery slope down. And I keep going back and back and back, and why this and why this and why this. And I'm like in 1066, the Battle of Hastings, like, I'm like, whoa, you know, or I'm like the Peasants' Revolt in Germany. You know, because it's like, that was fascinating. It was like 8 months, like peasants are like, rawr, you know, I'm like, what? It's like, but then you think it's put down violently. And then these people, where are they shipped? Where are they going? All of these working class peasant revolts all over Europe, you know, these things, and they were put down one by one. And then these folks are shipped places. They're sent off to the colonies. They're sent to penal colonies. They're sent all these places. So it's like, these people are coming over traumatized by trying to like have a better life. So then they go over here and of course they step on somebody's head so that they can have that better life, because like they've been stepped on. I think it's really important for empathy, you know, to just think, I mean, England was a terrible place unless you were elite in the 1600s and the 1700s. It was a terrible place. I mean, it just was, you know. And it's just kind of like you could be thrown in prison for nicking a piece of bread when you're starving. So this music is coming from these people who were enslaved and transported across the ocean and separated from everything that they knew. I mean,
listening to you talking about it, Rhiannon, just shows that you have so much passion for it. And you've also, just to uncover these things, to educate people with your music, with all of your different artistic outputs, you've also written books, children's books, and contributed to works on the history of music. How did that begin? And would you say it's just a natural progression from expressing these ideas through music and then being much more direct with words and engaging in public discourse eventually?
I've always wanted to write a book, which is what I'm working on right now for adults, the kind of the history as I see it of kind of American music. So I'm working on that right now. The kids books came from the pandemic, you know, it was kind of a pivot and has turned out really well. So, you know, the thing about lyrics is that they're very direct, you know, especially the way that I write very much based on traditional forms of like ballads and things. And you don't have a lot of words to say a lot, you know, and you have to fit in a lot. And that's kind of the case for children's books. You know, you got to say a lot with a little. And you have to say it in a way that just dispenses with all the crap, you know. I've written my third one that's not based on lyrics. This is the first one not based on lyrics, and that's in the process right now. And it was just, it was very similar to writing a song, you know, or poem. It's like, you know, you really want to get to the cut to the chase. And so that's been really amazing to have that opportunity. And so I'm very, and, you know, when people ask me, I speak about these things in an informed way, and that's evidently not super common as for musicians, you know what I mean? Like I'm a super, super nerdy person, and I write music from a historical perspective. You know, I'm not just writing about my boyfriends or, you know, my kids or my life, which is nothing wrong with that. But I just, like, there's enough people doing that. I don't need to do it. I do it a little bit, but I didn't really like it. So I'm like, you know, anytime I've written from a personal perspective, I'm like, never again, because that's not where my interest is. I'm like, you know, my life is whatever. But like, so it's, you know, being able to then write an essay, you know, or to write an article or to be a talking head on a documentary or on a podcast. I've done a bunch of those. I feel like I try to represent.
You're saying you're writing music from a historical point of view. That must be really difficult and hard to be doing this cultural and historic work within a very hyper-capitalist music industry.
You're like hitting all the points. This is like, I tell people I'm doing like non-profit work in a profit industry. You know, it's like, it's crazy. And it is crazy making. I mean, the MacArthur, I got a grant, which is one of those that you don't apply for. They just give it to you. Like, you know, you get nominated for it. And that was huge, you know, because it got me through the pandemic. I was able to buy a house. I was able to have stability so that I can then take these projects, continue to take these projects. So I'm going to take them anyway. I'd just been, you know, starving while I did them. But outside of that, yeah, I'm like, you know, selling records, talking about slavery, you know, it's like, it's kind of crazy, but I somehow managed to do it, you know, and have had these opportunities because of the banjo that I play and because of the story that I tell, like I did a video game because of the sound of my banjo. Like it was just set in the Wild West. It was Red Dead Redemption 2 is one of the biggest games in the world. You know, people still come up to me like, you're on Red Dead. Oh my God. You know, that's how I got into your music. These young gamer bros, you know, it just was like, what? So I've been very fortunate, you know, to just get enough to kind of keep going. Like I'm never going to be a millionaire, but like I get enough opportunity to keep going with this work, you know?
You've spoken before about feeling rather invisible in the past or at times within parts of the Black cultural mainstream. And when you see Black audiences now today dancing to the banjo or artists like Beyoncé bringing the banjo into mainstream pop culture, what does it mean personally to you?
The experience of doing Texas Hold'em was challenging, and I won't get into the negative aspects of it, but the positive aspect of being attached to that Beyoncé song was that I had finally had a little bit more visibility within Black culture. And it's not even mainstream. I'm not mainstream in white culture. Like, you know what I mean? But the Black nerds got hip to me through the Beyoncé song and also Sinners, the vampire movie by Ryan Coogler. Like I was a musical advisor on that. And I've seen more and more Black people in my audiences, which has been amazing. I'm never going to be in the Black mainstream, which is fine. But like, I just wanted a little bit more visibility just so those folks who are like me know that I'm out there and can come to the banjo and see the whole atmosphere. There's not just me. There's obviously other people doing this. That was kind of the idea, which is why I said yes to those things. And I do see it working, which has been amazing. There's more and more Black folk who are picking up the banjo. There's like now banjo circle. I'm funding some banjo circles, like, you know, trying to get banjos into the hands of people who really want to learn, but don't have the money to get a banjo or whatever. I've really seen an upswing in that in the last few years, which has been incredible. You know, because I wrote articles defending Beyoncé's right to make country music. I mean, there's just so much emotional labor for nothing, like nothing other than the cultural mission and the service that I mean, I don't start with money. as long as I make enough to like take care of my children and my family, like that's fine. But that's one reason why I'm always exhausted, because I can't, it's hard for me to say no to things where I feel like I can make a difference with my words or my time or be able to foreground somebody. But if I'm not there, they don't get the gig, you know? So it's kind of like, I'm really trying to figure out at this point, like I'm almost 50 and this work is wearing on me. You know, it's a very, like, I'm doing constant research in minstrelsy and trying to figure out how to make all of this, not lose the cultural artifacts that are trapped with this racist imagery, you know? And it's exhausting, but I wouldn't trade it for anything else. I just have to figure out how to not burn out. You know, I've gotten really close.
Is there ever a moment where you just want to break out of that and just do something just for fun? Like music just for fun, concerts, playing just for fun?
I'd like to get there. Music tends to be part of my mission, but that's my yarn collection. So that's kind of what I do. Those are my yarn books, my crochet books.
That's a whole bookshelf wall of that.
Yeah. So I'm just thinking about this stuff all the time. Like I don't really watch TV unless I'm like watching something with my kids, you know. I'm like learning the concertina. I'm learning how to juggle. I like to draw. I did a book of, this was my latest kid's book where I did all the illustrations. I love this so much. This was so fun. That kind of keeps me like brain soothing stuff so that I can, you know, and people are, what's been really nice is people within the community, like Black people who are trying to figure out how to learn this stuff. How do you learn it? How do you, you know, and are kind of coming up to me and giving me my flowers, which has been amazing. That's been really incredible. Like people coming up, there's one woman came up to me and she said, thank you so much for taking the hit for all of us. And it just like, I almost cried because it was just like, that is what it is. It's like, I'm doing this work so that they don't have to do it, you know, and they can start with the music as just music, as just cultural connection, and know that it has this history, but they don't have to necessarily dig in the dirt to get it. You know, that's what I'm doing. And that's obviously what I've been led to do because I can't stop doing it. Like I have so many books. Oh my God. And it does actually energize me, like to learn the history, to get these books being put out by these academics that are like really top notch, modern, contextualized, showing their position, you know, really connecting the dots in a way that's just really powerful. So I feel really lucky to be alive right now and to be able to have access to this knowledge put in a way that is whole. You know, it's a lot of really great work being done.
There is, and especially coming from you, and you're bringing a lot of it to Hamburg as well, which is so exciting.
I'm so excited.
With your Reflector Festival at the Elbphilharmonie. Yeah. And it feels like so many different strands of your creative work are coming together. We haven't even talked about your opera yet, or opera in general. And yeah. We're going to hear excerpts from Omar. You'll also be speaking about your book, Go Back and Fetch It. You're going to perform as a singer and as a banjo player. And you'll just be curating 5 days of concerts. Mm-hmm. What was your first reaction when you were invited to create the festival here?
I got super excited. It's like, I love it when I get an opportunity to bring my family. And I don't mean my blood family, although they're often part of it because they're creators and musicians and artists, but my musical family, you know, how I'm really seeing it very clearly the last couple of years, like how I work is I create relationships with musicians doing similar work to me or adjacent work. And over the years, you know, whenever I have an opportunity, I put it out to connect to those folks. And I connect to the same folks, you know, and I grow. So we have relationships, like say Layla McCalla, for example, like she's someone I have a long relationship with. She was a Carolina Chocolate Drop. She, you know, I was on her record. She's on my record. Like we've just, and I've just watched her, you know, grow as an artist and a historian herself. Like she's an incredible musician and composer. And so anytime that I feel like, oh, that's something that I think Layla could bring what she does to this, you know? And so now we've done that so many times. I know her work well enough to know we could do this with Layla. She could fit in here because I know what she's doing. And so like that, to be able to then cross the streams. So to be able to cross, you know, the work that I've been doing with Silk Road and the folks that I've brought into Silk Road, to cross that stream with the, you know, some of the folks that I've been working with on other kinds of musics, and to see how to create something like the African Diasporic Connections, you know, that concert is really all of these different threads that I'm able to bring together in a concert that is just unthinkable in terms of just putting it together. But because of the festival, it means that I can bring these folks in for these things, and then they all cross on this evening in a way. And I think that's the whole point of the festival, right? It's like you, at least as how I saw it, you know, it was like, I'm always thinking about how to connect. It's all about connections for me. That's how my brain works. It's like, this is over here, this is over here, this is over here, and this is over here. And then they can all come together here and show this, and like, what an opportunity.
It's exactly what I thought when I looked at the program, because it just moves so fluidly between Baroque music and then banjo traditions, intimate solo performances, these huge ensemble worlds. It is just all of that in those five concerts. Is that maybe the narrative thread that connects all of these things, that they are in the end one and not many different?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's like, we're not all the same thing, but we all want the same things. You know what I mean? It's like, we all want to find love. We all want to eat. We all want to be sheltered. We all want a friend. Like, all of the desires that humans have are all the same. How we talk about them maybe is a little different. How we make songs is a little different. You know, you do it with this kind of music, we do it with this kind of music. But like, ultimately, the differences are cosmetic. And I think for me, that's always the desire with music, is to show how similar we are. Music is an easier way to do that than verbal language, for example. You cannot speak the same verbal language, but you can figure out a way to speak musically to each other. And it's not always easy. That's the other thing. It's not always easy. I mean, working with the Silk Road Ensemble, you take some things for granted, and then you make music with somebody from another part of the world, and you're like, oh, we don't think about this the same. You know what I mean? But what it does is it makes you think about your assumptions. You know, when you're trying to communicate with somebody, you have to investigate your own assumptions in order to find a common tongue.
Mm.
And that's what music is so good at. Like, it makes you go, oh, I'm just assuming that everybody thinks of the one the same way, but they don't. You know, I'm just assuming everybody thinks that C is this, but they don't, you know? So it's just always such a great opportunity.
You've talked about the Silk Road Ensemble. You've been their artistic director since 2020. What have you learned? Exactly what you just talked about, connecting with each other, playing music together. What have you learned from that experience with the Silk Road Ensemble?
I mean, all of those things. I've learned that intention is really important. Not everybody even wants to make music in the same way. Not everybody has the same feelings about it. So it's like, you want to work with folks who have, like, it ultimately, it doesn't matter what musical language you speak, as long as you have the same desire to communicate. It goes back to that kind of underlying human wants and needs. And so with Silk Road, everybody in there, you know, really wants to communicate. And so I've learned a lot about different systems, you know, different systems of counting, different systems of how you think about the tuning, how you think about what a key is. And then also, obviously, the rhythms, you know, I've brought in more people from African backgrounds, you know, into Silk Road from Congo and from Morocco. And then, you know, placing that next to Indian classical music, next to, you know, classical pipa music, like it's everybody's got a slightly different way of thinking about things. But when you the conversations that are had over a tune, how do we start this tune? How do we end this tune? What do we do in the tune? You learn how to communicate in general. For me, it's a real masterclass. It's like you watch a rehearsal of Silk Road because we're a real collective. Like I'm the artistic director, but it's more like, here's the project that we're all going to make together. You know, here's the idea. Here's the focal point. And I think that I've learned, I feel like diplomacy, people who are diplomats could like learn a lot by just watching a Silk Road rehearsal, because you see people, okay, so who's doing the solo here? Who's had a solo? Who, how are we going to play this together? How are we going to make sure that she's doing the thing that she does the best? How are we making sure that he feels comfortable and blah, blah, blah. And it's actually really beautiful. And we always find the song that needs to be found. We find the arrangement, but we have to figure it out. And sometimes we try something, it doesn't work. We try, you know. So I'm just so grateful to have had the experience, you know, and honored to be at the head of such a talented group of people. And I feel like we're just kind of finding our stride in this new, you know, kind of new format, you know, Silk Road 2.0 kind of. And it's been really exciting.
That's quite interesting what you said there with ambassadors or people could learn something from that, how you communicate, how you work together as an ensemble. And I feel like sometimes just something needs to be working in the micro before it can work in the macro. So maybe a lot of people will see those concerts and feel inspired by how you are connecting with your musical family.
I hope so.
What would make you feel after the final concert that this Reflector Festival truly mattered?
I mean, you never know what people take away. And sometimes you don't know until like 20 years later, somebody will say, you know, that changed my life or whatever. All I can do is hope that. So for me, where I'm entering right now is making sure that all of the performers have the same experience as the audience and that everybody feels fed, that they walk away a better person, that they walk away with something they didn't have before. And that would be my hope, is that it strengthens my musical community, doing these concerts, bringing them to Germany, engaging with German history, engaging with, you know, being, what does it mean to be doing this? And I don't mean World War II. I'm talking like George I didn't speak English, the English king. Like, you know, he spoke German. They brought, you know, the intersections between the top two immigrant groups, you know, for a long time in the United States were Germans and English. So it's like even having that, I think, is really interesting. You know, I'm more interested in it because it is in Germany, because it is in Hamburg. Obviously, the Elbphilharmonie is incredible. It's an incredible space. Like, that's a whole separate thing. But I think that that's what I love about being based in Ireland and being closer to Europe. Well, I'm in Europe, you know, but being closer to mainland Europe, because it's kind of, it's not, for me, it's not enough to just reconnect to like Africa and what's going on in Africa and places like Senegal and, you know, Nigeria that have huge sort of really notable connections to the United States in the history, but also in Europe. I think right now it's really important to connect in ways that are unusual and bring out things other than the tropes that we just kind of sit on, you know, especially in the States. It's just the same stories that get told, you know, and there's way more interesting stories to tell.
And I'm so excited to hear your stories at the Reflector Festival. Rhiannon, this has been an incredible conversation. Where we started, where we ended. I'm so excited for your festival here. Thank you. Have a lovely day in Ireland. Bye.
Das war der Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie mit ausgewählten KünstlerInnen aus unserem Programm. Wenn du keins der Gespräche verpassen willst, abonniere uns doch einfach auf deiner Lieblingsplattform und lass natürlich gern immer eine Bewertung da. Für Tickets und Infos zu den Konzerten in Elbphilharmonie und Laeishalle besuche uns auf www.elbphilharmonie.de. Dort findest du in der Mediathek auch weitere Podcast-Formate sowie viele Konzertstreams, Interviews, Hintergrundartikel und spektakuläre Musikvideos.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.